All right, here's what you need to know about today. If you want to be on TikTok, you need to know the rules, the new rules. And yes, they're Israel's rules. Volodymyr Zelensky goes on a wild rant at the Munich Security Conference. It's vulgar, it's kind of crazy, and you're going to be able to hear it. And then Jeremy Corbyn has a bit of a go at it as well. He had already told The Guardian that NATO caused the war in Ukraine, and wait till you hear what he's also saying about Boris Johnson. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm going to let you know that we're following a developing story right now. There is a conference that is taking place where they are negotiating, hopefully, what will be the resolution or the end to this war in Ukraine. There you see the top negotiator for Russia, Mr. Medinsky, and there you also see Mr. Witkoff, Mr. Kushner, the admiral representing the United States, and we are told that at any moment now, we might be getting some kind of comment after this first round of meetings. And when that happens, we want you to know that we are going to break in and share it with you. It'll likely be Mr. Medinsky who will come out and speak. So once again, as soon as that happens, I'm going to share that with you so we get hopefully some kind of good news on what's happening between these two sides in this negotiation, Russia and Ukraine. Now, back to today. If you watched our show yesterday, you saw a passionate discussion regarding the Iran crisis and how Israel is trying to dominate and control that narrative, which I challenged. Here, take a listen. Mr. Ben-Menachem, let me ask you a question. Are you on the record here on our air saying it's perfectly fine for a country to give hundreds of millions of dollars to the president of another country? Are you saying that?
Miriam Edelson is not a representative of the state of Israel, and she did not give the money, the donation, in the name of Israel. This is done privately without any connection to the Israeli government. On the contrary, she's against the Israeli government. So how can you say that Israel is the one who's giving the hundreds of millions of dollars to the...
Okay, what about AIPAC? What about AIPAC? They apparently have given 94% of Congress money directly, and the minimum that any congressman has gotten is over $110,000. I mean, that's direct money from AIPAC. Are they just citizens who have no connection to Israel?
AIPAC is a lobby. They are not representing the state of Israel. They are a lobby organization in the United States. You can find different organizations that are giving money to politicians, to American politicians. What has got to do with the Israeli government?
They have an Israeli flag on their logo.
They're not part of the Israeli government.
They have an Israeli flag on their logo at their events. Netanyahu speaks at their events. You tell me how it's supposed to be seen.
And they fund IDF. The conversation reminded me, by the way, of one of the most painful moments in my career. It was a different time. A time when questions like that were not even allowed to be asked, or you'd be out the next day or sooner. But I said it. I asked anyway. I said that Jews in the United States with ties to Israel had more power and more representation in the media than any other group in the United States, and that they're clearly not an oppressed minority in the media in the United States. In fact, in the media, they have a vaulted position in America. Here's what I said.
Stewart's a minority as much as you are.
Come on, how is he a minority? Yeah,
Rick,
very powerless people. I'm telling you that everybody who runs CNN is a lot like Stewart, and a lot of people who run all the other networks are a lot like Stewart. And to imply that somehow they, the people in this country who are Jewish, are an oppressed minority, yeah.
By the way, I apologized if anybody was offended by what I had said, but the fact of the matter is, and this is important, Jewish Americans are not an oppressed minority in the media. They're not. For saying what I said, I was fired. I was humiliated. I was forced into the wilderness. It was, by the way, a big-time story at the time. Here's Newsweek. Sanchez fired after implying that Jews run the media. Notice it says implies, because I didn't say that Jews run the media. I never said that. Here's another one. Yahoo News. This, too, went all over the world. Talk shows made fun of me, news networks and their broadcasts all ran with it as well, as you might expect. So, okay, fine, whatever, right? Fast forward now. Let's move forward 15 years and look what happens. Knowing all corporate media is pro-Israel, which it is, obviously, and now everyone knows that, People all over the world turned to social media instead during the Gaza massacre. And the platform they generally chose was TikTok. And TikTok exploded with information, exploded with videos and real stories about Palestinian civilians and about workers and about volunteers and reporters and doctors and nurses all being slaughtered. In some cases, video of this stuff. So what happens to TikTok? It is shut down. Is that what I think? No. That's what U.S. presidential candidate Mitt Romney admits. Here, listen to him.
Yeah, a small parenthetical point, which is some wonder why there was such overwhelming support for us to shut down potentially TikTok or other entities of that nature. If you look at the postings on TikTok and the number of mentions of Palestinians relative to other social media sites, it's overwhelmingly so among TikTok broadcast. So I'd note that's of real interest, and the president will get the chance to make action in that regard.
There it is. We had to shut it down, TikTok, that is, because too many people there were criticizing Israel and defending Palestinians. That's why we shut it down. But it gets worse, really, because you have to ask then, okay, so what happens next? I'll tell you what happens next. Billionaires in the United States with ties to the Israeli government are mandated then by Netanyahu himself with the task of buying TikTok, which they do. Why? To make it impossible for people to use that powerful platform to criticize Israel. Am I just making this up? Am I just saying this? No. The new CEO of TikTok admits this. Here he is.
We made a change to designate the use of the term Zionist as a proxy for a protected attribute as hate speech. So if somebody were to use Zionist, of course you can use it in the sense of you're a proud Zionist. But if you're using it in the context of degrading somebody, calling somebody a Zionist as a dirty name, then that gets designated as hate speech to be moderated against. We also have, I think, over two dozen Jewish organizations that are constantly feeding us intelligence and information.
It's crazy, isn't it? The notion that people who criticize a country or an ideology or simply have a different opinion should be shut down, banned, or removed took center stage this week. Again, this time it's a bizarre rant from none other than Volodymyr Zelensky. This is absolutely crazy. But he says it. Here it is.
Europeans made a lot, but didn't put still sanctions on nuclear energy of Russians, on Rosatom, on people, on their relatives, on their children, which live in Europe, which live in the United States, which study in the universities of Europe, which have real estate in the United States. So they have a lot of real estate. They have children, relatives everywhere. F*** away to Russia. Go home.
Yeah, that's a really bad word. He said the F word. He said the F word. Then he added it with F away. And my first reaction when I heard him say this is, first of all, what? What's he talking about? But when you listen carefully, you can hear what he's suggesting. He's suggesting the removal of all Russian immigrants in America and Europe as well, by the way, no matter how long they have been there, including their children and their families, if they don't agree with him, with Volodymyr Zelensky and the Ukrainian point of view. Here, listen to it again.
They have a lot of real estate. They have children, relatives everywhere. F*** away to Russia. Go home.
Yes, it's vulgar. It's a rant, and it sounds crazy. But, you know, it made me think of something that Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told me recently. Remember when I sat down with him about a little more than a week ago? According to him, and what he tells me, what Zelensky wants done in America and in Europe, he's kind of already done in Ukraine. It's his MO. He and his government, not the Ukrainian people, but the government and Zelensky, have been banning all things Russian for quite some time. Since 2014, the Zelensky government has systematically removed or banned the worship of the Russian Orthodox churches, or playing Russian songs out. Speaking the Russian language, banned. And now, more recently, there's even a move to ban Russian authors. Can you imagine, from libraries? Think about that. Tolstoy, Chekhov, Dostoevsky, Pushkin. Not allowed? Crime and Punishment, War and Peace, Anna Karenina, Dr. Zhivago. Gone. So, will Mr. Zelensky's crazed rant force his European sponsors to pull away even more? At least one extremely prominent Brit seems to say yes. He seems to think so. I didn't expect this from Jeremy Corbyn. Maybe I misread him. But he's in the news. He's UK's former leader of the Labour Party, as I'm sure you know. A few years ago, he told The Guardian that NATO should be disbanded, which was interesting. His thinking is it's already outlived its usefulness. But now he's going even further, right? Beyond that, he's saying, I watched him say it, he's admitting that what few European elites will say, that Russia was purposely provoked, and that's what started the war, that NATO was wrong. In an interview that I'm about to play for you with my friend and fellow podcaster Katie Halper, he goes so much further. He calls Boris Johnson, by the way, a man with a catastrophic ego for undermining the Ukraine peace deal. And he, by the way, he's critical of Russia for the Ukrainian offensive, but he squarely puts the blame on Europe and the EU and NATO, not just for provoking, but for prolonging the war in Ukraine.
Boris Johnson's involvement was catastrophic for Ukraine and for everybody else. I mean, he is a man with an enormous regard for his own abilities and his own ego. And he informed Zelensky that he was a sort of latter-day Churchill, and that Zelensky should stop listening to all these voices about doing a deal with Russia, and Boris would be there beside him to sort it out.
Once again, to remind you, we are expecting any moment now to have some video or the appearance of the negotiator on the Russian team, Mr. Medinsky, and perhaps others. Whatever we get, we'll bring it to you right away. It's a subject that's obviously very important to many people who watch our broadcast. Joining us now to take part, to take all of this apart, is Dr. Hassan Ünal. He teaches at Başkent University. He's an expert on Turkish foreign policy, European political history, West Asian politics, and Balkan politics. There's a smart guy. Dr. Hassan, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, sir. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you, Rick.
I just got back from Iran, and I started thinking to myself, and I wanted to ask you about this. If might makes right, we're living in the right time for that thinking, aren't we? Because it seems to me the United States wants the oil in Venezuela, so they kidnapped the president of Venezuela. The Israelis want to dictate what kind of negotiation the Americans have with Iran. So Mr. Netanyahu gets on a plane and flies to Washington and tells Mr. Trump, this is what I need you to do. I mean, you almost can't blame them. They've got money, they've got power, they've got authority, they've got input, and they're using it. Is that the kind of world we're simply living in right now? Do we just have to face the facts?
Well, it seems as if it is. You know, we are living in a world now, a small country like Israel is dictating terms to a superpower like the United States on anything and everything, particularly anything pertaining to Israel and to the Middle East. This is totally unacceptable, and some of the U.S. experts calling it, an occupation by Israel of the United States, which is almost true. You know, you can't explain all this. You have, as you explained, Prime Minister Netanyahu getting on his plane immediately and then arriving in Washington to simply dictate what Trump should say and should negotiate in the negotiations with the Iranians. It is, I mean, I have been learning and teaching political history of Europe in particular and the world in general. I haven't seen any such instance in which you have a small country dictating terms upon a superpower like the United States.
We almost have to give them props, don't we? I'm almost thinking I mean, I hate to say this because I disagree entirely with what they're asking for and what they do and what they want, even in my own way personally throughout my career, but I guess props to them. How can somebody this small become the most powerful country in the world? Can you explain it to me? Because I don't understand it. Is it just money?
Well, presumably a number of factors we have to basically take into consideration. You know, what has come out of the Epstein files and what other things we people like you and I don't know, are not aware of. There may be lots of other things that gets involved in the policy making in the United States when it comes to Israel or Israeli-related affairs in this part of the world. And the other thing is, what does Israel really want? What does it achieve? What does it want to achieve? What is security, ultimate security of Israel? For instance, are they going to, for instance, take on, say, Saudi Arabia after Iran, or are they going to take on Turkey or Egypt or any other country for that matter? And where does Israel's ambition really end? So are we going to have peace in this part of the world? And, you know, if Israel goes on like this, destabilizing the whole region, and the United States simply... how shall I say, dogging behind the Israeli demands all the time and doing what Israel wants them to do. And then where is it going to lead to in the end?
But is it only the United States? Because, you know, when I look at this picture, I see a lot of weak states in this part of the world surrounding Iran and surrounding Israel that seem to go along to get along, as we say in the United States. I see countries like Egypt and Jordan who simply take money from the United States to shut their lips and let whatever happen, happen. And I see the Gulf states essentially also doing in much way, in many ways, kind of the same thing. Your country, right? You're in Turkey. Last time I was in Turkey, everybody in Turkey was, not everybody, but a lot of people in Turkey would say to me, yeah, you know, our president talks tough, but when it comes down to it, he's got all kinds of deals in this country with Israel as well. So is there enough, isn't there some culpability to go around even in the Middle East from countries all throughout the Middle East, including yours, about this subject?
Well, in real terms, Turkey doesn't have a dispute with Israel. So we don't have a disputed island problem with Israel. We don't have maritime dispute. We don't have any other interests, basically clashing interests with Israel. What our involvement basically involves is just simply humanitarian side of the side of the whole thing. So when Israel basically commits a genocide, the Turkish government cannot refrain from criticism. And the criticism, for instance, would be directed at Israel, but it should also, and it does actually, help the Arab states' positions. Because Turkey is a state, and it basically acts together with the states that are, as you mentioned, Jordan, particularly Egypt, with which Turkey has extensive cooperation in Eastern Mediterranean, and the Gulf Arab states and Saudi Arabia, all of them are Turkey's cooperative partners. So from the Turkish point of view, what do you do? You know, if those Arab states don't want to do something serious against Israel, or something to contain Israeli danger, if you can put it like that, then it is not up to Turkey to basically contain Israel until and unless Israel gets in our way, for instance, acting together with the Greeks in Cyprus or somewhere else, pushing things to extremes and what have you. In the case of the Arab states, it's a complicated story. The Arab states, they got into action, if you remember, when Israel attacked Qatar. Now, until then, the Arab states did not necessarily respond to what Israel has committed in Gaza. But when Israel attacked one of them, they got together and they started talking about an Arab NATO, and what came out of all that is a solid alliance between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Turkey seems to be interested in sort of not getting into the Saudi-Pakistani alliance, but at least to be friendly with, Turkey is quite friendly with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. But the trouble is, you have a rising Iran on the doorstep of the Arab states, and to the Arab states, Iran seems to be more of a threat. I mean, they should get together to
more what?
Hammer out their, you said their differences. Iran, but it's,
I didn't understand the word you used.
It's a complicated issue.
You said Iran should be more, is starting to become more what?
No. What I'm saying, to the Arab states, Iran seems to be more of a threat in terms of their perception. So, I mean, they should get together to hammer out their their differences and to find a common ground on which they can act. But it's not easy. These things are easier to say than to get done, of course.
But that's interesting you say that, a threat to the Gulf states. But are they really a threat? If the Gulf states are going to allow the United States to have military bases, huge military bases, where they conduct everything out of their countries, then they're in actuality or seemingly in bed with the United States. So how can the Gulf states say that Iran is threatening them? Iran would probably make the argument, which they did to me, no. If the United States attacked us, we have to attack the United States' interests. The United States' interests happen to be in those countries. So that's where we have to hit. How do you argue with them on that?
Well, that's their dilemma. And the dilemma existed even before the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Remember, under Shah, for instance, who was extremely friendly with the United States, and then you had Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Arab states, all of which were allies and friends of the United States, but there was again this dispute between them. So there's always this, on the one side of the Gulf, you have the Arab states, on the other, you have Iran, which is, so there is this problem of perception. Hmm. So the perception basically, goes on, regardless, despite the regime change, for instance, from Shah to Islamic regime and what have you. I mean, all of us would agree that Iran's focus is Israel rather than the Arab states.
Yeah.
But how can you explain it to the Arab states? When Iran has a big arsenal, okay, then they would say, I mean, I'm all with you, basically arguing for a common ground between the Arab states and Iran. But how can you do it? When they were all friends and allies of the United States, they couldn't. And now one side is the bitter enemy of the United States, the other side, all of them are totally dependent on the sort of security that the United States provides for them. So it is a tricky situation. It's not easy.
I would argue the United States is not an enemy of Iran, and Iran is certainly not an enemy of the United States. Iran,
oh, definitely.
I'm an American. Iran has never threatened me, harmed me, anything other than the chance they keep talking about. But if we're going to base foreign policy on chance, you got a pretty crappy foreign policy. This is between Israel and Iran, and Israel gets the United States to do its bidding, and it's fighting for it. That's really what it is.
Well, I thoroughly agree with you on that. When you get, for instance, Iran doesn't threaten the United States or any assets of the United States, or wouldn't threaten the United States assets in the region. But for Israel, that is why, all this brings us back to the first point we talked about. Who is basically, now, as the saying goes, who is the dog and who is the tail? whether the dog actually, you know, as they say, now the tail seems to be controlling the dog.
Yeah, we could have a lot of fun with this, and we would go
That's
down.
That's right, and absolutely. So even in Turkey-United States relations, you have that. Turkey is a reliable member of NATO, and it's been like that for decades and decades. It has had working relations with the United States. We have had disputes, problems, disagreements.
But
when it comes to Israel, you have lots of problems again with the United States.
But here's what I'm thinking as I listen to you say, and I respect what you're saying. You're a diplomat and you understand that things have to go through processes. Turkey can't just come out and all of a sudden come out with different policies, and neither can a lot of these countries. But I do wonder, though, if one side can play that game, why can't the other? I was just thinking to myself as I was listening to you, I was thinking the West, when it doesn't like a country, will say, from now on, your planes cannot land here. From now on, we will not buy your goods. From now on, you are boycotted. From now on, you are tariffed. From now on, we'll make other Western countries not do business with you. They do all kinds of things like this. They did it to Venezuela. They've done it to Iran. They do it to Russia. They do it to countries all over the world. It's like they just say, you know what? We don't like you, and we're going to make sure we bury you. But it seems like the countries now who could use that same argument or maybe even that same policy with Israel say, nah, we're not going to play that game. We're not going to stoop to the same level that we've seen the West do in other countries. Maybe. The question is, why not?
Well, I mean, that would be the ideal world. But there is no ideal world in which we live.
Tit for tat. Tit for tat, right? Yeah.
Well, tit for tat does exist, actually. When, for instance, Russia is sanctioned, Russia does also use whatever assets and whatever other possibilities to use against whoever is sanctioning Russia. Or again, in the case of Turkey, Turkey could do it. Mm-hmm. Or any other country, particularly China. China is quite a strong, how shall I say, anti sanction power, if you like. It has all the weaponry in its hands, so it can respond quite effectively to the U.S. pressure. But the problem is, I think, looking at the whole thing from a historical perspective, what we have been witnessing is the collapse of a big empire. And it is not going to happen overnight. It's going to take time. And whenever it can actually turn against one country or the other, it can still harm that country or a group of countries. Huh. But in the end, this is definite that the empire is collapsing.
And the part of the empire which seems to be collapsing the fastest right now is the European side, it seems definitely to me. I think the Americans, my country, is going to hold on to its power for some time. But the choice, you get this, the choice the next American president or this American president or a future American president will have to make is, do we stay with the old team or do we look for a new partner to dance with? And there's some really good, attractive partners out there. China, Turkey, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, India. And they're thinking, well, do we continue to just show up at the dance all the time with, you know, Great Britain and France in our arms? Or do we find some new partners to bring to the dance? And that's kind of where we are right now, aren't we?
Well, certainly the problem is with Europe. I think the dearth of leadership and leaders with vision and understanding of international politics, I think they are doomed to think ideologically. Over decades, they have been instilling into the minds, the Americans and the others, they have been instilling into their minds the ideology that is, you know, democracy, human rights, freedoms, and what have you. And then each time, all these things have been used to instill into their minds anti-Russianism, anti-China, anti-blah blah, anti-Islam, anti. And you have, for instance, Israel, which has basically committed a genocide in daylight, and then they are still talking about the same sort of what they call values. I mean, then you can say, what democracy, what human rights, what, you know, democracy a la Gaza, human rights a la Gaza, this, is this what you are talking about? But the problem is, look at what happened when Rubio basically delivered his speech in which he said the United States is out to start resuming colonization in the old sense. And he was given by the European leaders, so-called leaders, a standing ovation. So what's all this? So I think they are so disoriented. And they think, for instance, countries like, say, Denmark things, well, if we have a Cold War again, that would basically give us the opportunity to, I mean, we could save Greenland, if you like, okay? So thanks to the Cold War, the Greenland was put into the deep freeze. And if we have another confrontation on an ideological basis against Russia, against Iran, something, then we would remain United States' dear friend and ally, and that would save Greenland for us. Kind of thinking, you know, this is the mentality. Until and unless this liberal elite is basically swept away through democratic elections, we are not going to have proper European countries with proper foreign policies, you know, looking after their own interests.
I'm wondering, you know, a trend that I see happening with this administration, and we're following it right now. We, in fact, as you and I are speaking, any moment now, I'm told Mr. Medinsky may come to the microphone, and the Americans are meeting with the Russians as well as the Ukrainians to try to come up with some solution. It seems to me that if the United, going back to this thing you and I were just talking about what is the United States' role and what is it going to do in the future? Will it kind of walk away from Europe somewhat and move to a new partner? I think with this administration, they're looking at Russia. They're seriously looking at Russia as the biggest country in the world with the most hydrocarbons, with the most rare earth minerals, or second most of rare earth minerals, with a real possibility that that's maybe where they can make or forge a future marriage. I think they're looking at it. I think they would like to see it happen. I know it's difficult. As a guy who studies this, what do you think the U.S. intention is there?
The current administration in the United States is certainly looking to Russia as a prospective partner, because they have expressed their disagreements and even frustration with the European countries so many times. When you study all the points of the prospective peace treaty to end the Ukrainian conflict, then you get certain things that has been basically put there with no with nothing to do with the Ukrainian conflict or to ending the Ukrainian conflict. It is all about prospective cooperation between Russia and the United States in very important things. You know, when and when you listen to what Trump has been saying, because Trump doesn't write normally things, articles or blah, blah, but when you listen to what he says and when you, you know, analyze them, it is all about, you know, important things like oil, gas, and then precious metals and all that sort of thing, rare earth minerals. And he talks about them extensively. And when you also analyze why he's eyeing Greenland, for instance, and why he wants Canada to be part of the United States as the 51st state of the United States, you understand, basically, he wants to enlarge the United States territories in a place, particularly along the northern coastline of the Arctic Ocean. And Arctic Ocean has all sorts of things, rare earth minerals, you know, fishery, and anything you can think of. Arctic hasn't been basically, it hasn't been exploited at all. Hmm. It is waiting to be exploited. So you have Russia to the south, southern coast of the Arctic, and then you would have the United States, if he can get Canada and Greenland, and perhaps later he will also try to acquire Iceland, for that matter. So Russia is a jewel for the United States. And in the end, if he can also get Russian, not necessarily Russia as not as an ally, but sort of Russian cooperation, not in an armed confrontation, but in containing China one way or the other, then that would be great for the United States.
Yeah.
So he has all these things in mind. The sort of things liberals cannot actually grasp.
Exactly. Or those who don't understand the true multipolarity that is taking place in our planet as we speak. By the way, the Russians,
exactly.
I think the Russians would be willing to date the United States. In fact, that's the sense I get from my conversations with people like Dr. Medinsky and Sergey Lavrov. But they won't be a cheap date, I'll tell you that. They will not be a cheap date. They'll be earnestly tough with their negotiations as they're being right now. Speaking of tough, I want to ask you about Turkey. I'm kind of fascinated by Turkey. Turkey is the one country in the world which is in such a unique place. You have relations with the United States. You have relations with, obviously, Europe. You're a part of the European community. You have relations with Asian countries. You have good relations with Russia and Mr. Putin. You have good relations with Xi Jinping and the Chinese. How does Turkey manage to remain powerful by staying in the middle like that? What's the secret?
Well, the secret is multipolarity itself. Basically, I wrote and spoke about multipolarity. I have been speaking and writing about it over the last 20 years and saying, well, look, when unipolarity collapses and replaced by multipolarity, it is going to offer Turkey lots of opportunities to conduct a multifaceted and also multidimensional foreign policy.
Mm.
So you remain in NATO, but at the same time, you cultivate best possible ties to Russia. And at the same time, you keep all the communication lines to Ukraine. And we are not a member of the European Union, but for instance, now the Turkish defense industry is eyeing Europe as a possible market. Okay, so there are so many countries which need to rearm one way or the other. And then because we are a NATO country, we have the NATO standards. So we can produce the sort of weapons and the ammunition which NATO standards require. So at the same time, you know, you can also you can have best possible relations with Middle East countries
and China. Mr. Erdogan went to China. He went to the Shanghai summit, didn't he?
Oh, he always does. Except his policy in the Middle East, because his policy sometimes gets blurred by ideological inclinations, if you like, being a bit too friendly with Hamas, then you estrange the Arab countries who are all against Hamas. Okay, so they would say, what have you got to do with Hamas, for instance? You can deal with us through state-to-state relations kind of thing. But other than that, you know, the geography certainly offers Turkey all sorts of opportunities to conduct that sort of policy.
Let's finish with this, the news at hand, so to speak. See how I can phrase this question so you can better understand it. I got it. Do you believe Mr. Trump's personal interests in the Gulf states and the U.S.'s interests in the Gulf states, places like Kuwait, places like the UAE, Oman, et cetera, Saudi Arabia, obviously, will preclude the Americans from wanting to bomb Iran for fear that this thing will escalate and end up raining on their interests in that sacred area for the U.S. geopolitically and from a business standpoint? Answer me that.
Well, this is one of the major factors that they always take into consideration. But there are also other things. For instance, if you attack Iran now, and then Iran rains down with missiles on all the U.S. assets in the Gulf area, and even further beyond the Gulf, hitting the American warships, and particularly the carriers. And imagine one of the carriers going down into the ocean, Arabian Sea, sorry. And then at the same time, Iran basically bombs down Israel in a way that has never happened in the history of Israel since its establishment in 1948. This was largely like that during the 12-day war. Mm-hmm. So Iran basically demonstrated what it could do. And once you have that, now Netanyahu is going to the elections. How could he win if Iran basically rains down with all the missiles? And how could the U.S. Congressional elections be affected by what happens? Yes. So it's not an easy thing. It's not going to be easy. So it's a big, big, big challenge for both Netanyahu as well as Trump and the U.S. administration.
To be clear, you are agreeing that these conditions that I set forth and you added to would likely or could very much preclude Mr. Trump from bombing Iran.
It could.
Yeah, yeah.
But it would take time. Meanwhile, the negotiations would have to linger on this particular subject, on that particular subject. But the problem is going to be the Israeli lobby. How would the Israeli lobby take all that, machinations by the Trump administration to slow down the process? How would they basically pressure Trump and his administration? So that point of view, it's not easy either.
I don't know if you've noticed this, but first of all, there's a new poll out that says 70% of the American people do not want to attack Iran, which is significant. But the other thing is there's a trend in the United States these days where the American people for the first time are fighting back against the influence of Israel. In fact, they're fighting back against the influence of neocons who want to start wars in the Middle East because Americans are tired of paying for this crap. And they're saying this, especially Mr. Trump's own party, the Republican Party. The MAGA movement is saying, no more. We don't want Netanyahu coming here and telling us what to do. We don't want to start wars in the Middle East. Spend our money here, not over there. There's a lot of that going on in America. Have you recognized that?
Oh, certainly. I keep reading, for instance, certain polls which suggest that 60 to 65% of the Americans are against Israeli policies. They are not necessarily anti-Semitic, but they are against Israeli policies quite clearly. And the Israeli lobby is quite concerned about all that because never has there been a time in the U.S.-Israeli relations where you have the public is really turning against Israel for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So it is quite a concern. It is quite concerning for the Israelis and how this public attitude is going to basically influence the U.S. policy making in concrete terms remains to be seen. But it won't take long.
That's why Israel just bought TikTok. That's why they bought CBS and why they're about to announce they're buying CNN. But you know what? I don't think that's enough. I don't think that makes a difference with most Americans because the people who are angry about these things are people who watch this show and Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and other shows that are not necessarily part of the corporate media. Dr. Unal, what a wonderful conversation, Professor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Just one thing, Rick. And when you monopolize media, basically people form their own opinion.
Yeah.
They don't get carried away by a monopolized media. They should learn from a lot of experience that political history would teach them.
Yeah, yeah. You have some of that. And that's why it's been so great to have this conversation with you. I look forward to talking to you again, Professor. Thanks again. Regards.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, that was a good conversation. By the way, on the big story we did today about Zelensky, we've been already getting a lot of comments on Zelensky's rant. I mentioned it yesterday in one of my podcasts. Usually the comments when I talk about Ukraine are about 50-50, because there's a lot of people out there, half of you when you write into me, who defend Zelensky and you attack Russia. This time, though, I noticed that it seems most of the people were more critical of Zelensky for saying what he said, that Russians should be expelled everywhere. Let's start with Eats Back. He says, the Europeans and the Americans have created a completely rogue regime now, headed by a crazy person. Sleeping Bear. Sleeping Bear. That's great. Says, sounds like a dictator who wants to kill every Russian in the world. That's democracy. Sam Garcia says, Putin is being too nice to Zelensky. I'm surprised that he's still there. This guy has the West brainwashed. Andreas says, Zelensky is going to be remembered maybe as a delusional, narcissistic puppet clown destroyed, puppet clown president who destroyed Ukraine for the USA and NATO, plus the military-industrial complex. I want to make sure you get the right grouping in there. And Ellen Stromier says, we would like to send Ukrainians back to Ukraine. So, end this war. Amen, Ellen. Amen. I, too, would like to see this work out for the sake of the Ukrainian people, if nothing else. They're good people, generally, and they're pawns, and they deserve better. As usual, all of the feedback is appreciated. Check out my page on YouTube. It's called Journalistic Speaking. I'm also on X. There I go at Rick Sanchez TV or Twitter or whatever you want to call it. And BitChute. We're soon going to be doing a lot of stuff on BitChute. I know, I keep promising. We're setting it all up. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be looking for you next time. Thanks for letting us in your homes. Good night.